Cape Town's executive mayor, Jordan Hill-Lewis, has been in the news quite a bit recently. There's good news. In fact, it's just about everything is good news at the moment as far as the young mayor of the mother city is concerned. We're going to catch up with him, long overdue, on quite a few interesting developments. The moving across to the Democratic Alliance, his party, of the leaders of the major opposition parties, EFF, and the ANC, and Franz Cronje's warning that maybe they're Trojan horses. That was a bit hectic, I thought, when I spoke with Franz, Jordan, about the moves of the leader, first of the ANC, in the Cape Town Council, and I had a fascinating interview with him. He seems to be really focused on making a contribution, and I haven't yet managed to engage with the leader of the EFF, who's also joined the Democratic Alliance. But
yep.
I thought it was room for celebration. Franz said, watch out. In politics, it's a dirty game. They could be Trojan horses. What's your assessment of that?
I'm more optimistic. Good evening, Alec. It's really nice to join you again. I'm more optimistic than that. I think it's a cause for great encouragement that more and more people from across the political spectrum are realizing that the Democratic Alliance is the place to be if you care about really what's best for South Africa and how to fix this country and get it out of the doldrums, get it out of the deep, deep hole that it is in. And both of them, proactively came to the DA or approached us. And both of them said they really recognize that that's what's happening in Cape Town, that they can see the effort being made despite huge challenges, despite massive informality and all the things that we know are the big challenges. They see the effort being made, and that I think is reason for celebration. Of course, France's basic point that there's lots of kind of low integrity people in politics, that is undoubtedly true, and time will tell. But I think ultimately, if the DA is going to win, and we really must, if the GNU is showing anything, it's that we have to replace the ANC in South Africa if we are to fix this country. We have to add people to our cause. We have to attract more and more people, and to see that happening is encouraging.
It's quite interesting, given the dangerous nature of politics. Just this week, we've had another political assassination, this time in the Western Cape. It doesn't happen as often here as it happens in KwaZulu-Natal, but that is concerning.
It hardly ever happens here. And, it's very widespread in KwaZulu-Natal. I always say to my colleagues in KZN, it's a tough ask, frankly, to go into elected politics in KZN, where political assassinations are actually very common. I can't remember the number, but something like 90-odd political assassinations have happened in KZN over the last few years. In the Western Cape, it's been very rare, and that's why the murder that we saw in Stellenbosch a couple of nights ago is very alarming and upsetting. I really hope that's thoroughly investigated and whoever's responsible is arrested soon.
Do you have any insight into what might have gone on there? And indeed, did you know the person who was murdered?
I did know him. I did know him, and we were colleagues together, and I met him a few times. I didn't know him very well, but all my colleagues who work with him tell me that he was doing a great job, that he was a wonderful colleague, and there's no immediate obvious explanation as to why this happened, and that has to be thoroughly investigated.
Yeah. It's one of those things we can all speculate, and goodness, there's enough on social media of speculation of what happened behind the murder. But the point of it, the fact is, it's dangerous to be in politics in South Africa, and that's why the moves of the leader of the ANC and the EFF in your city across to you was, I suppose, it caused so much circumspection, I'm sure, within their parties, but. You have to wonder at the courage of these individuals.
Well, let me say, I know Banele Majingo better than I know Lungiswa Ntshunche. And Banele Majingo is in many ways quite an impressive and courageous person. He's been the leader of the opposition as long as I've been the mayor. We've actually had a very positive working relationship with one another. I've always found his questions in council to be incisive and better prepared than his colleagues, and he's always shied away or veered away from political grandstanding, and has always chosen really the most constructive or positive contribution that he can make. So I've always actually been impressed with him, and I think he will add a lot of value and do good work in the DA.
Moving on to your budget, which has received some criticism as being terribly socialist, but on the other hand, you've just got an upgrade of your rating from Moody's, which would suggest that you are running things very sensibly. What's your take of the criticism that you're seeing, and how do you respond to it?
Some of it has been fair. Some of it has been hysterical. I must say, I had a good laugh, a really good chuckle, when I saw on Biz News one member of the public calling it "quote unquote" municipal Marxism. I love that. That's one for the books. That's the first time I've ever been called a Marxist, and of course, it's obviously ridiculous. We have seen the consequences of municipal Marxism. To use that quote, in Johannesburg and in Ekurhuleni and in eThekwini and every other city that is destroyed by the philosophy and ideology of the ANC in this country. And Cape Town stands as a beacon of exactly the opposite. Now, what we are trying to do in this budget is make sure that we can withstand the enormous pressures that we are facing of a rapidly growing city, of a city that has to contend with a huge number of people that unfortunately do require a cross-subsidized, heavily subsidized, and in many cases free services because they have no income to speak of whatsoever. So it's all well and good to say, as this one reader did, that everyone's got to pay a contribution. But in reality, you've got to make the books balance when you have to deliver billions and billions and billions of rands in free or heavily subsidized services. It's very hard, nigh impossible, to recover any of that from the customers actually making use of the services, for very easy to understand reasons in the South African context. Anyone who, frankly, has been outside of their bubble would understand why that is the case, because we have high poverty and unemployment. And that is why the DA at a national level and at a local level is so obsessed with growing the economy, because that's the only way that we can change that over time. And then, of course, the other thing we have to do is make sure that our city never, ever chooses the path of destruction that we've seen in all those other cities. And that is... that has happened, that has been occasioned simply by underinvestment over many, many years. Not investing enough in the assets that you have, not caring for the assets that you have, not investing in new assets to guarantee the success of the city. So the budget was certainly assertive and is ambitious. It sets up the city for infrastructural success. I think, as I've said, we can come as close as it is possible to offer some kind of guarantee that we will never, ever have the kind of infrastructural decay we've seen in other cities. And I think that that is really actually very good value for money. We are doing it, by the way, to go back to the allegation, the charge of municipal Marxism. We're doing it at the lowest cost in South Africa. And people keep telling me, well, you can't compare to other cities. But of course we can. Because in those places where that philosophy has actually been implemented, they have taxed their residents to death and have delivered nothing in return for that. Here we are actually delivering a successful, functional, thriving government. We'll get to the Moody's upgrade in a couple of minutes. A successful, thriving city at the lowest tax rates, the lowest municipal tax rates in the whole country of all the cities. That is a relevant comparison, I'm afraid. I must insist on that comparison. So far from destructive socialism, I think we are building the alternative And it's slightly ridiculous to suggest that as that one reader did. As for the other criticisms, let me say some of them have been valid. For example, perhaps too great a burden was placed on the shoulders of those living in what we might call the upper middle class. Now, of course, we know in the broader South African context, with 45% of the country living below the poverty line, if you live in a home of 3.5 million to 7 million, you're not really middle class anymore. But we also take the point, as many of those residents have made, that simply because you live in a property of that value does not mean that you're cash flush. We have taken that point and we've proposed various fairly considerable softenings of the budget tariff increases and implications, particularly to look after residents in that category. So to soften that cross-subsidization models somewhat, to lower some of the tariffs. And then the other criticism, which I fully understood, was those of pensioners. If you are above the age of 60 and you're living in a home that, say, you bought 20 or 30 years ago, it has grown tremendously in value because it is located in Cape Town, and that is part of our success story, that property owners have enjoyed tremendous increases in the value of their assets. But that means that you're now living on a pension, a fixed income, and so we are also increasing dramatically our support for pensioners, quite across the board. So I think we are responding to those critiques that make sense. And I will also respond in writing to the gentleman who wrote into your site to maybe put some pepper on the gloves a bit for those with slightly more ridiculous criticisms.
It is interesting, and I really do want to talk a bit more about Moody's in a moment, but the Western Cape has been attracting so many people from other parts of the country. Yeah. The semigration. I don't know if you are aware of the latest figures, but the numbers that Alan Windey gave us a couple of years ago was over 100,000 people that were coming, that were full on semigrating, not just guys looking for a job, any job, but bringing their skills, bringing their wealth, and relocating primarily to Cape Town, which yes. is a lovely idea. But it also might suggest that you could become a victim of your own success, because how do you grow the services for this huge influx?
No, definitely. I mean we are already in that position where the strain on the city's infrastructure is immense. If we use Alan's numbers, and I agree that Alan's numbers are probably even too conservative now. We've had a massive wave of semigration in the last 2 years in particular, probably faster than ever. 2 to 3 years, but if we take those numbers of 100,000 families, that's probably a minimum of 100,000 cars, probably 200,000 cars. It's tens of thousands of kids that need to go to schools in the area. It's all the pressure on the city's infrastructure, and of course the pressure on our housing supply market, where the private sector is struggling to keep up with responding to that demand in time. And so we've got real issues in the city to make sure that we simplify our permitting and building approval process, for example, so that we can answer that demand more quickly and not have people waiting a year plus for planning approval. We're working on that right now and trying to simplify that. And then, of course, the only solution, there's no other thing to do, is to invest at a much faster pace in infrastructure. You've got to invest for those coming to your city, you've got to invest for all of those that natural growth in the city, and you've got to invest for other pressures like state failure, the threat of energy insecurity, the threat of water insecurity requires investment. So you've got to constantly be investing.
And Moody's, if you can just really keep it basic for people who don't understand the bond market and. Yeah. Why is it so important that you get an upgrade?
Well, just like you and I, Alec, when we go to the bank and ask for a new loan, for a bond or whatever, the bank takes a look at our credit record and says, you know, you are a high-risk customer, or you, Alec, are probably a very safe customer. I'm a high-risk customer, and so they're going to dial up the price that they charge on that loan because they have to be compensated for that extra risk. And conversely, for a safe customer or a safer customer, they're going to dial down that price on that loan because it's much less risk, so they don't need that compensation. And it is exactly the same with countries and indeed with cities. Now, for the longest time, basically the rating agencies have looked at South African cities and said, my goodness, this is just a massive mess. We can't tell what's going on here. All of these cities are bankrupt, and they're all deep in the in the red junk status. And we've been having an argument. I've personally been remonstrating with them over the last 18 months to say, guys, you are tarring us all with the same brush. If you look at Cape Town's finances, it's in a different category. This is a well-managed city. We have a very healthy balance sheet. We collect on our debts. There's a healthy payments culture. It's, you know, this is a safe bet. And last year, July, they move extremely slowly. Last year, July, they put us on watch for an upgrade. And it's taken nearly a full year, another 9 months after that, but they have finally given us the full upgrade. And just to answer your question, the basic impact is that when we go and fund this enormous capital project, we can do so at a better price. And that's going to translate into savings for the public and or allowing us to fund even more investments. And so it's very, very positive, both for the city's reputation as a safe bet and for residents and for our capital program.
Do citizens appreciate it? Have you got the feeling or the sense from them that they know that this is actually such a big deal, because it does mean that the city will have to pay less interest, and we should know that from a South Africa Inc. perspective, where interest is really hurting us badly. 20% of all tax raised goes just on the interest bill.
Yeah, I don't think that most South Africans get how important this is. If you just look at our South African credit rating, obviously our country is still in junk status. And what that does to the bond market, or what it does to the interest payments now a massive, massive portion of our national budget, just paying the interest on our kind of national credit card, so to speak. So, if we could bring those costs down, you could literally at a national level save billions and tens of billions of rands in annual costs. But I don't think this is widely understood, but I must say I'm really personally chuffed about it, and I'm glad to talk to you because I know you understand this because we've really been fighting for this for at least 18 months.
I'm sure there are many in the BizNews tribe who are just as delighted, and those who live in Cape Town will know about that. I've got to ask you about Rob Herzog's recent conversation with me, where he said that the Western Cape should go off and talk to Donald Trump and his people in the United States and say, just don't punish us, punish the rest of the country, punish the rest of South Africa. That's the ANC. Don't punish us. We DA run. We haven't got an axe to grind with you, and so on. I know the DA has often resisted the temptation to support things, populist things like Western Cape independence and so on.
Yes.
But as the city of Cape Town, how do you stand in that debate, given that if the Americans were to get terribly excited about the Western Cape, and Saldanha is a huge, and Simonstown are huge opportunities or huge pieces on the chessboard, which are of relevance to them. How do you see all of this geopolitical issues when you're sitting in the executive mayor's job in Cape Town?
That's a very good question. I think I'd respond as follows: the values on which prosperity are built, the values of a free and competitive market, the values of a free speech and liberty, and a constant effort to expand individual freedoms. In other words, the values which have defined America's incredible prosperity over the last century or so. Those are the values represented by the Democratic Alliance in South Africa. Now, the best possible outcome for the ANC would be if they were able to cast themselves as victims. They love that. They, if you just think about how they associate with all of those their close association with the kind of Cuban cause in inverted commas, and how they position themselves as victims of American dominance, and take no responsibility for the absolute demolition job that left-wing and socialist ideology has done to that country. So the best possible outcome for the ANC is if they were placed in a position where they could paint themselves as victims, without any regard to the consequences of the country, because that's always last on the ANC's mind. It's all about how they can position themselves. And so I don't think that Donald Trump's victimization and targeting of South Africa helps actually to advance the values the same values which have generated so much prosperity and success in the United States of America. If he's interested in supporting those values and seeing those values come to the fore and come to the surface in South Africa, then he should not so easily place the ANC in a position where they are able to say, well, we can't take any responsibility for the disaster in South Africa because we're a victim of that scapegoat again. So I just offer that as a word of caution. As for engaging with them directly, I've got no objection to that. I mean, we must, I've always said we must fight for the interests of Cape Town and the Cape Town business community, and more broadly, the Western Cape business community and agricultural community. And most importantly, we must fight for the interests of Western Cape workers and people who are still to be workers, unemployed people who are desperately looking for a job. And so if we can engage in a constructive way to cool down temperatures and perhaps stop the vindictive tweets about South Africa, then I think that we can really have a positive impact. I'll give you one practical example of why this is important and why I wouldn't hesitate to engage. It's always better to engage. We've got a hotel developer right here in the city who has pushed pause on R1 billion hotel development, a brand new R1 billion hotel in the city. He's pushed pause on that development because he said there is just too much instability around South Africa coming from our relationship with the United States. And he is banking on that hotel being filled with American tourists in the main, and so there's real world consequences to these things, and job consequences for many people who desperately need them. So I wouldn't hesitate to engage.
Jordan, what about and I know it's not directly related to you, given that the port of Cape Town is still under somebody else's control, but what about the impact on the port of Cape Town of South Africa losing out on AGOA, for instance, and the Western Cape farmers there? Is there any way that you could get a free pass or get Cape Town get a free pass from whatever might happen there? I know you're very innovative, and we've spoken a lot about, and I want to finish off when we talk a bit more about load shedding and what you're doing on electricity. And people forget that you've been ahead of your time on so many things. But how about that as an option?
I certainly would not rule it out, because I think the consequences would be dire of losing that access, and particularly for one of the most job-intensive industries in the Western Cape, and that's agriculture. So it would be devastating for precisely the people that need the most protection and support in our fragile economy. So I would say we should absolutely not rule that out. We should explore every opportunity to carve out some kind of a free pass or whatever is possible. And you know, I'm sure you've been following the progress that we've made on trying to get the port privatized out of the dead hands of the state, and into private management hands. And we've recently had some success again through the relentless pressure over the last couple of years, when Transnet originally, went out on the Durban harbor. It was not their intention to do Cape Town at all. And just by sheer pressure and force of will, we have got them to include Cape Town now in the latest call for proposals. So hopefully we can get that harbor out of the dead hands of the state and get it working properly, so that businesses, and particularly agricultural businesses in the province, can grow. I've spoken to many farmers who said that their businesses could and should be 30% larger if it wasn't for the performance of our or the underperformance of our port.
Yeah, the break on prosperity through incompetence and poor management. Correct. Or poor decisions. Electricity, I have to come back to that, because your original 2021, your campaign promise about getting the Western Cape, or getting Cape Town, load shedding free. Now it's not load shedding so much anymore, but I guess it's cost. It's the way that Eskom pricing just seems to go through the roof continuously.
That's right. That's exactly right. I think the whole debate is shifting to pricing, and that's why we're continuing with our program of purchasing 500 megawatts on the private market from independent power producers. I can tell you all of the megawatts, literally all of them, that we have purchased are cheaper than Eskom's. And arguably more reliable. So it's a no-brainer. We're going to finish this first program of 500 megawatts of procurement. I've already started to say to the team, to my mind, it's an absolute no-brainer that we should ramp it up significantly from then, and try to actively reduce our reliance on Eskom power over time, even if it becomes more available. So that we can pass on the price savings over time to our customers and our residents. So that still remains absolutely our target and goal.
So when you go into your secret place and you start thinking about the future, and you apply the Elon Musk first principles approach, what is the first principle for Jordan Hill-Lewis right now as the mayor of Cape Town, when you look ahead and the next couple of years that you're definitely going to be in that job? What is it that you want to leave with, if you leave, that is, don't decide on another term?
No, that is an excellent question, and I can answer it immediately. I want to leave the city knowing with absolute peace of mind and with reasonable guarantee that the city will never be one of those other South African cities that sees only decay and destruction and collapse. That we have done all the things that we can possibly do to ensure that in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time, when my children have got children, that this will still be a successful city because of the things that we are doing now. And frankly, regardless of what happens elsewhere, that we know that we are sorted on water, sorted on energy, sorted on infrastructure, that we can cope with the pressures that we are set up for success. And if I can return the city to that place of comfort, that peace of mind that comes with knowing that those things have been done, I will be a very, very happy man indeed. Then nationally, I think all of us, increasingly, I think more and more South Africans are coming to the conclusion that as useful as this GNU is, and of course it is very useful and positive, but we have to ultimately replace the ANC. So long as the ANC remains the largest party in South Africa, we simply will not be able to, at a philosophical level, at a principled level, turn around the government to the extent needed to actually unlock prosperity in our country, which is what we all desperately want.
Jordan Hill-Lewis is the executive mayor of Cape Town. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.